stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burnt, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defence of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the side's joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism.
Iran and Syria are two long-time allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the ninth consecutive time, and a tenth increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table, to continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting, because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission. We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day when millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in Turkey to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein. Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries ago. But now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists. In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the holy book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year, mashallah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the Grain Deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African. With Russia's strong return, opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. Sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang. The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
This is IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As eviction moratoriums have expired, along with other pandemic-era protection, homelessness is on the rise in the United States. It is not uncommon to see tent cities which have sprung up in more and more cities as Americans are being priced out of the housing market. The price to rent or buy a home is getting more out of reach for many Americans. Now, this is homelessness has been climbing steadily by 6% every year since 2017. That, along with Americans' personal debt, rising food prices, and basic supplies, do not paint a rosy picture for many Americans. Well, stay with me as we're going to take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. But first, this report.
From Vermont to Texas, desperately needed coronavirus-era social programs are ending in the United States. On August 1st, many areas ended their moratoriums on debt to landlords, meaning nearly a million children are now at risk of eviction in the city of Los Angeles alone. Families have the highest risk of losing their home, while half of those saying they expect to be evicted are Black or Latino. Evictions in the United States have recently soared to reach double what they were before the pandemic.
Lost our jobs because of the pandemic, lost everything we had because of the pandemic. We found a place to live with a buddy in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but he died, and that was in March. And so we decided to come out here because we thought there would be more opportunities. We're just hoping to get jobs and get into a place to live, and get a car and function. And that, so far, we've been struck out. As you can see, we're packing our bags. We're going back to Colorado.
America's decentralized model of federalism makes a nationwide approach to the evictions wave impossible. Public camping is illegal in many places, like Texas, which makes it harder for charity workers to find and help the homeless.
I had a stroke, and I was bleeding on the brain, and, you know, I had to go to rehab a lot to learn how to walk and talk again and all that. I've only been homeless like a year and a half. I went to Cornerstone Shelter, Sarah Circle Shelter, and now I'm in a ton. But I got a caseworker, I went to church, and the Cornerstone supervisor told me I popped up on her computer and I got, you know, she's got housing for me.
Other vital social services are also being withdrawn. Millions of Americans, including children and new mothers, just lost their medical coverage for the first time in 3 years after Washington refused to extend the pandemic-era program. College tuition debt represents an incredible 7% of U.S. GDP. In October, 41 million Americans will have to start repaying an average of $400 per month, and many say this alone could push the country into a recession. A lack of affordable housing is something that any committed government can easily fix by writing laws which favor tenants instead of rich landlords, by putting more tax revenue into building more public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight. Cecilia Johnson, human rights defender and author out of Chicago. Charles Simmons, social activist, educator, and political analyst out of Detroit. Well, thank you both for being with me. Good to see both of you. Well, let me start this off in Chicago and Cecile. Cecile, what's going on? Why are we seeing this deterioration in the way we are, especially when we look at the situation of housing in the United States?
Well, poverty is an issue. Lack of affordable housing is an issue. We just came out of COVID and many of the things are going to be ending. But in reality, in Chicago, we have about, you know, 70% of those experiencing homelessness are Black people. So this is because many of the places that people live are poorer areas. You know, we are only 30% of the population in Chicago, but we are a third of the people who are, you know, suffering from poverty. And that's gone up with COVID, where a lot of people did lose jobs and other sources of income. So that's part of the squeeze.
And Charles, why are we seeing these housing prices increase in the way they are in most cities, that it makes it even difficult for people to be able to afford rent, and for sure, very difficult for them to buy?
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming.
I think it's important to put the homelessness within the context of the overall domestic crises. We have a crisis not only in housing. And let me point out that many of the people who are homeless actually are not unhoused. They are living somewhere. Many of them are living in their cars or trucks. People that have campers they're living in now. Many people they're living in in basements of vacant buildings. So the actual the official data is very unreliable because much of the homelessness is disguised. In addition, many people who are working full time are homeless in the United States, and I've seen this for the past 30 years at least. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it is getting worse. Now, I would say also put it within the context of other social crises, such as a crisis in healthcare, crisis in public education, because the budgets for public education have steadily been declining over the past 30 years, along with the deindustrialization of the nation. There are cuts in libraries, there are cuts in mental health facilities. We used to have mental health programs in the communities that were free, and we no longer have those. The prison population is on the rise. And I would also say that I would put a label on all of this as a war on working people in the United States. And along with the global wars that we have been involved in over, continuously since World War II, that has created another level of spending that should be going to solve domestic problems. For instance, the money we spent in Afghanistan, the Afghanistan war, 20 years, trillions of dollars that we can't even count. We don't even know. But we do know that the money on the Afghan war, just for a few years, could pay for and solve the housing problem in the United States. So the housing problem is not an accident. It's an intentional problem.
Well, let me just jump in right there. You said, Charles, it's an intentional problem. Why would the powers that be want to make that a problem in the country?
Well, because real estate is a big industry, and so they don't want to build affordable housing because it's not profitable enough. It's more profitable to make expensive housing for rich people. And so the budget for low income people has just declined radically. The budget for middle income people has declined radically. So that's why I say it's not something that's necessary. And I was comparing what's happening in the United States with Cuba. I was in Cuba a couple of months ago. 85% of the population there has a family home, and evictions are illegal. And I'm talking about in a poor country. They are able to house the majority of their people in a livable environment. And we can't do it in the United States, rich country.
Well, Cecile, in 2020, it was estimated that it would take $20 billion to end homelessness in the United States. Since the start of the Ukraine war, the Biden administration has given at least $75 billion in aid or cash to Kiev. Let's talk about priorities for Washington and what is going on. How can they actually prioritize other entities first besides their own people?
Well, it's clear that there is no political will to do that, as you can see by the votes that come in, right? And yes, here's a country that has all this money to invest in war and none to invest in its people. It's not just the housing. We have a crisis in so many different areas, as the brother has pointed out. So it's about lack of priority. In Chicago, we have an example where the Ukrainians, they took a school. We have a very large homeless population, and I say 70% of them are Black. And when you look at recently, they had a school that was converted. So we had like 50 schools that were closed over a period of years, the last decade, and could have been used to house the homeless. However, it wasn't until the Ukrainian war that they bused people to Chicago and they converted a school, and I think spent $15 million of our taxpayer dollars to do that. So it's not that people don't know what to do, but when it comes to us, the local people, somehow there's no political will to do
so. So let me just understand what you're saying, dig into this a little bit more. So you're saying that when Ukrainians went to Chicago, that schools were converted into housing for them?
There was a school that was converted into housing for, I think, about 150 people. And the question is, why was that same thing? Since we do have these schools that have been, you know, closed over the period of time, and many of them were in black areas. In fact, where they were putting those people, the Ukrainian community was asking for them to be in their community, and instead they were putting them in our community. So, yes, you know, why was this a priority? You know, we have a new mayor, so we can't blame him for this problem. He's inheriting some problems, and he's tried to be more humane. However, you know, this is not rocket science. You have old schools there. They could house the homeless. You've renovated it for the Ukrainian refugees. So why not? Why couldn't you have, did the same thing for your own people within Chicago, you know, or any place else?
And you're saying, Cecile, sorry to interrupt you, and you're saying that you believe racism plays a role in all of this, because you brought up some statistics at the beginning. Is there a demand? Has there been a demand from the black community, especially when they saw the situation with Ukrainian refugees coming in and getting facilities, getting things that the black community and perhaps others don't have? Have they demanded that the government, some government accountability for this?
Well, we've had people speaking up, because with the new mayor coming in, he's been holding town halls and, you know, different meetings. And so people have been speaking up about some of these issues. But it is, I think it's racism, and not because we have now have a black mayor, but because of a system that has been in place that has historically not paid much attention to the black population. In Chicago, we used to be 40% of the population. We're now down to 29%. And I believe that some of these conditions are created to deliberately cause us to move out of the city. We've lost over 250,000 people, right, from 2000 to 2015. So it's probably up to like 300,000 now. So, and that's the black population. So you're creating these conditions of hardship, which make people leave and go other places. You have housing vouchers sometimes that they sit on, you know, millions of dollars worth of housing vouchers. And then when, like the gentleman said, it's better for them to have high-rise, you know, expensive housing than affordable housing. And so you've seen a loss of affordable housing in Chicago when they got rid of some of the projects, and many of these people were then displaced all over the place. So I believe that some of that is what has also caused the homelessness. Okay. So it's about priorities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Charles, how is it that during the last 40 years, when we look at China, it has been able to reduce extreme poverty by 800 million people, when Washington has seen an increase in poverty, when the American economy has been much bigger and much stronger than the Chinese during this time?
Well, there's an intention on the part of the Chinese to serve the needs of the people, to raise the living standard of people, of working people, family farmers in China. That does not exist here. We could do it if the government, the leadership intended to do it. It could be done. Yes. But there are my sister Cecile raised some very important. It is a very racist issue. The affecting African Americans and people of Latin descent from South America. One of the issues is that the loans for housing, black people end up paying more for interest rates than white people do. And that there's a process here called redlining, which divides the community in sort of an apartheid system, that certain areas on the map cannot get loans, certain areas can get high interest loans, other areas can get low interest loans. It's a very racist map system that they use. We also have what's called gentrification here, in which people who are wealthier than the ordinary workers can go and buy up the property when some of the working class people get behind in their payments. And so there's a major shift over in the past 30 years of homeowners in Detroit. The racial population, African Americans, were about 80% roughly of the population in Detroit, where we have about less than 700,000 people in total. So there's the favoritism in the allocation of loans for housing, and there's a favoritism for other types of consumer loans. Now, the debt, you mentioned personal debt at the beginning. Since 1970, the real wages of workers in the United States was stagnant. In fact, it's moved backwards, so that people in 1970 actually were making more money as a working class person than they are making today. Often, the grandparents are making more real money, real wages, than the grandchildren are. So China doesn't have 800 military bases around the world either. China may have two or three. I haven't been able to find out information about more than that. But we have military bases throughout the planet, over 800. Those are like small cities. The American taxpayers had to pay for that. The working people had to pay. The rich people really pay proportionately less taxes than working class and so middle class.
Well, Cecile, do you think what we're seeing in the United States is the result of decades of neoliberalism, which, of course, prioritizes the need of the 1% to the 10% over the majority of the people?
I would say that is so, and especially now where we have this backlash on everything that has actually given or attempted to, because I don't think that we have come very far to give us any rights to move forward, right? So when you think, based on what Charles just talked about, we have, when it comes to home ownership, the rate 60 years ago was 40% for Black people, and it's still 40% today. So there's been no growth in that. In Chicago, you had banks lending 12 cents on the dollar to the whole Black community and the whole dollar to the white community, like four areas on the north side of Chicago. So there's definitely bias.
That's taking place, you're saying?
Yes, that's happening right now, right? 12 cents on the dollar, right? So you have not, when you are trying to buy a house and you're Black, you have so many hoops that you have to jump through. It's like ridiculous. And we've seen cases. I heard an interview where a woman, and she was white, was trying to move into a Black neighborhood to kind of, increase, just be more diverse. And the things that the bank put her through, she was going to have a two-family house, so she would have had income. That's usually a plus. And by the time they ran her through the ringer, she had to end up going somewhere else where she bought a one-family house, which was actually more expensive for her. Right? So the banks do this. He's right about the redlining. It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. So these are the things that are still happening and must be addressed. And like you say, in Chicago, I think that there's a long-term agenda to displace us. So therefore, they do make things more difficult. People lose their homes for the taxes, right? Taxes have gone up. When TIF funds are supposed to be spent in our communities, they're not. They end up being spent in areas that are already doing nicely, right? And then gentrification is real. They are slowly taking over, coming down on the south side, west side of Chicago, and taking over our communities. And yes, when you create this kind of hardship, it means that properties are cheaper. for those who have money, right? Mm. So it's a never-ending cycle.
Indeed. Well, Charles, with everything that you've said and this lack of equality across the board, do you think that this will ultimately cause the downfall of neoliberalism in the United States as we see this changing world from a unipolar to a multipolar world? And we see examples of other countries and what they're doing. I mean, you talked about Cuba at the beginning of the show, or China, or so many other countries. I mean, do you think this will ultimately bring down that neoliberal system there because of the needs of the majority of the people?
I think it can go either way. It can go further to the right and become a fascist state. That's a possibility. It can also become more of a workers-oriented state, because we have right now strikes in labor organizing that's going on at a pace we haven't seen since the 1930s during the Great Depression. So young people are organizing all the various jobs, professions, and it's a new type of organizing that's going on. The young folks who are organizing now are people of color. They're Black, Latino, and Asians, and they're women. So we've got a totally new type of leadership that I expect will have more of a consciousness towards serving the people in the communities as well as in their jobs. And that was something that wasn't done with our previous labor leaders, who were mostly white and skilled laborers.
So are you hopeful? Are you hopeful?
Mm-hmm. I am hopeful. I believe that the combination of the youth working for and the trade union movement, the environmental justice movement, they're working in the housing, dealing with homelessness. I see a lot of enthusiasm among young community activist leaders in a way that I haven't seen probably since the 1960s. And mm-hmm. It's a multiracial movement now, more so than before, where it was major, in the 60s, major Black and brown movement.
Okay.
So young white people struggle now, and that's going to make a major difference.
And Cecile, you nodded mm-hmm. your head also. You're hopeful. 30 seconds. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful, because we've moved into a new time. As you can see, globally, people are rising up. You know, we have to try something new. What's happening now is not working for us. So I'm hopeful, because we must be the change we wish to see.
And on that note, thank you both. Pleasure talking to both of you. Cecile Johnson, human rights defender and author out of Chicago. Charles Simmons, social activist, educator, and political analyst out of Detroit. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, saying goodbye for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
has been growing concerns among British charities and campaigners that with the cost of living crisis continuing to rage, increasing numbers of British people are turning to often expensive forms of credit to cover everyday spending and expenses such as food, housing, and fuel. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. New data showed personal loan rates have doubled in little more than 18 months, spelling far higher costs for financially squeezed households hoping to borrow money. In early December 2021, just before official interest rates began their seemingly relentless march upwards, someone with a good credit rating who was looking for a new £5,000 personal loan to be paid back over 36 months would have potentially been able to access Best Buy rates starting at 3.3% from companies such as Sainsbury's Bank and the AA. Fast forward to this week and Best Buy rates for the amount and loan terms started at 6.6% from Sainsbury's Bank. However, in many cases, the top rates have more than doubled. Several loan providers have been offering rates below 3.5% in December of 2021 are now offering rates at 7.2% and even higher. Also, the rate someone is offered will depend on their personal circumstances, so many people will be asked to pay a rate that is considerably higher than these Best Buy rates. However, even based on a previous and new Best Buy rate of 3.3% and 6.6% respectively, that means new customers who can now access these rates are having to shell out an extra £267 in interest rates over 36 months for the same debt. The numbers were compiled for Guardian Money by Andrew Hager at the personal finance website Moneycombs. Andrew Hager says, people hoping to borrow money via a personal loan or credit card are facing far higher costs since this cycle of 13 consecutive interest rate rises kicked off back in December of 2021. He adds, rates for Best Buy loans have doubled, so changing the car or home improvement borrowing is now far more costly and at a time where consumer budgets are already stretched to bursting point. In Britain, there has been growing concern among charities and campaigners that with the cost of living crisis continuing to rage, increasing numbers of British people are turning to often expensive forms of credit to cover their everyday spending and expenses, such as food, housing, and fuel. According to new figures from the Money Charity, the average credit card debt a British household stood at £2,350 in May of this year. That was up from £2,197 a year earlier and £1,938 in May of 2021. The most recent data from the Bank of England revealed that the average interest rate on the credit cards hit a record high of 20.44% in May. Some loan providers have been pushing through fairly chunky rate rises lately. Some John Lewis partnership cardholders have just been told that their purchase rate will rise from 20.72% to 24.49% from 30th of September this year. Credit card rates are variable, although in many cases they are not explicitly linked to the base rate. However, the Moneycombs data shows that the rate has definitely been creeping up. In December of 2021, several of the leading players, including Barclaycard and HSBC, had interest rates for purchases of 21.9% for new customers. Andrew Hager says, in recent days, These stood at 24.9% and 23.9% respectively. He adds that the credit card rate examples above apply to new customers, but that unfortunately the reality will have been even worse for some existing cardholders whose rates are linked to the base rate. Andrew Hager says, "It's a case of roles reversed, with savers now enjoying decent returns for once, while borrowers have seen cheap money deals simply disappear." The most recent Bank of England data also stated that the average rate on new personal loans to individuals stood at 8.27% in May. Meanwhile, a typical overdraft rate is now just a little over 21%. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has also covered the same story and tells us more. Almost 8 million British people are thought to be teetering on the edge of a financial cliff. Consumer group Which warned of a debt time bomb after household bills rocketed. The families it classes as drained and desperate earn less than £20,000 and cut back to skipping meals. But Which also has concerns about their anxious and at-risk group, which accounts for 7.9 million adults. These tend to be from large families, have children, and have managed to stay afloat by using credit. Which says they are much more likely now to have borrowed money to maintain basic living standards rather than limit food and energy. But with interest rates still rising, they may soon start struggling. Almost 40% of this group has a mortgage or loan on their home. A fifth of those with a mortgage are on a variable tracker mortgage, meaning their rates are hiked every time the Bank of England base rate rises. One woman from Northern England said, "I have to use credit to make ends meet and I do worry about debt. I have no safety net for emergencies and I will have to work past state pension age." Rocío Concha, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Which, said, "Until now, the British government and policymakers claimed they have focused on supporting the millions already failing to make ends meet. But this ancient and at-risk group is a ticking time bomb." Rocío Concha added, "They are far more likely to have relied on borrowing, but with the interest rates continuing to rise, it's only a matter of time before they find themselves facing serious hardship. The government must help those most in need by tightening regulation on buy now, pay later loans, and ensuring businesses are doing everything they can to ease pressure on household finances." The website of This Is Money has also reported on the same story. Britain's mortgage lenders saw an increase in the number of customers defaulting on their loans in the 3 months to the end of June and expect more borrowers to miss payments in the coming months. Lenders' responses to the Bank of England's credit conditions survey revealed a 30% increase in mortgage defaults in the second quarter of this year. This was an increase compared with the 3 months to March, when the proportion of missed payments increased by 14%. Lenders expect defaults to increase again in the third quarter as rising interest rates and inflation continue to batter British households and its finances. Stephen Perkins, Managing Director at broker Yellow Brick Mortgages, said, "They're already rising, but lenders are expecting losses and default rates on secured loans to increase even further in the next quarter, which is unsurprising given the heights that interest rates are now reaching." Stephen Perkins added, "Demand for credit is also expected to fall in the third quarter, which again is what you would expect in such a brutal economic climate." He added, Repeated increases to the Bank of England's base rate have done nothing to curb inflation and are massively impacting the economy and pushing millions of British families' finances beyond the brink.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.